Good evening. It's a privilege to introduce a scholar whose work is thought-provoking, challenging, and influential. I'm doubly privileged because today's speaker, Lane Crothers, is also a colleague and a friend of mine. I'm here to extend my heartiest congratulations to Lane. I'm also here to speak about his work. The program brochure provides a brief description about Professor Crothers' career. I hope you will take time to read it. I'm not going to recap the information. Instead, I will say a few words on his contribution to the discipline of political science. To speak of Lane Crothers' work in brief is a challenging task, I must confess. They are diverse, they are incisive, they are highly provocative, and of course, they are very engaging. Anyone going through the list of his publications, especially his books, will be able to appreciate. Topics of his books include militia movement in the United States, globalization, and American popular culture. The title and the topic of today's lecture, again, is a case in point, making tea. It is customary in political science, and perhaps in other fields as well, to define a scholar by his or her subfield, by his or her primary area of interest. We tend to describe our colleagues as comparativist, Americanist, so on and so forth. In my understanding, Professor Crothers defies such limiting and limited identification. His work transcends the narrow confines of any subfield. Although Crothers' work takes American politics as the point of departure and focus on what we tend to call the domestic politics, their implications are by no means limited to the United States. Take, for example, his work on right-wing militia. He draws on the sociological literature on social movements, but explores the connections between the movement's ideology and political culture. This unique framework helps us to understand not only the movement here in the United States, but also in other countries and other cultures. This is one of the many contributions of Lane Crothers in expanding the horizons of political science. The towering presence of Professor Crothers as a person when he's standing next to you and as a scholar when you are trying to understand the complex relationship between political values, cultures, and actions cannot be ignored. His contributions warrant recognition, and the College of Arts and Sciences Distinguished Lecturer is one of the many ways to recognize, and this is just only the beginning. Lane, congratulations for a well-deserved recognition. Thank you.
Professor Crothers. Oh, you did? Okay, well. It's Kim, okay. Yeah, they stripped the script on me.
So, okay, we from Asia are used to being ignored. I think there's got to be something, if you're going to talk about tea, to have two South Asians introduce you, right? Good evening. I'm sure it was not without some trepidation that Dr. Crothers asked me to introduce him on this august occasion. Perhaps because almost all of our time together is spent in trash talk, banter, and general irreverence. But Lane is nothing if not fearless, as will be attested to by anyone who has watched him wade cheerfully into the minefields of sundry arenas and states of being that would give lesser humans pause. University politics, the golf course, a recent marriage, and now forthcoming fatherhood. But he was clear that I should not exceed 5 minutes, and that if I needed to, I should lie. So here are my attempts to subvert the truth. Most of you in this room are quite familiar with the public persona that is Lane Crothers. Dr. Riaz has delineated for you his remarkable career, the books, teaching, and general contributions to education and public life. His analyses of local and national political trends have found him on the airwaves quite regularly. And his interest in the way popular culture intersects with global politics has led to many of his recent publications. Most of you know him to be a polemicist, one who will not only refuse to shy away from an intellectual fight, but who will indeed seek it. I have come to believe that this putative spoiling for a fight springs not merely from a perverse desire to mix it up just for the heck of it, but because his Fabian sensibility is deeply rooted in the belief that intellectual engagement, even emotional debates, are windows to an understanding of the peoples of this world. Indeed, to him, they are the avenues to change. All right, yes, he does believe that he's always right. But he can be brought around to an opposing viewpoint, particularly when he has time to recollect in tranquility the errors of his arguments. Ask Martha. It is this curiosity that has sent him on intellectual journeys to far-off and interesting places, Australia for one, and recently Britain and Europe, from where he delighted us with an almost daily blog that recorded his quizzical descants on peoples and places. It is this curiosity that I find most endearing about him. I mean, how many born and bred Americans in this room would sit through an entire cricket match on TV with two aficionados waxing eloquent on the finer points and history of the game? And he seemed genuinely interested, if somewhat lost on occasion. Cricket doesn't have the infield fly rule, but is filled with several quirks too complicated to explain easily, and certainly not over a beer. He also visited, at my urging, the most famous cricket field in the world, Lords of England, watched a club match there, and even walked on that hallowed ground, then sent me pictures triumphantly. He always needs to win, you see. I'm sure he hasn't been to Yankee Stadium. The point here is that very little is too arcane for his attention. He sees the world as a jamboree filled with delightful tents, all waiting to be sampled. And then there was Istanbul. Who goes to Istanbul when it's snowing? He did. That could almost be the title of a memoir. It snowed on me in Istanbul. Of course he would go to Istanbul, snowing or not, that most significant of cities at the confluence of so many civilizations and cultures, gateway between two continents. He is, after all, a student of history. I first met Lane on one of my tours of duty on the Academic Senate when he was chair. During that time, I was struck by how passionate he was about the shared governance ethos of ISU and with how much equanimity he chaired those sessions. It was clear he cared deeply about the institution, cared about how it was governed, and cared that every constituency found an equal voice at the table. It is no accident that he was awarded this year the University Outstanding Service Award. It is also no accident that newspapers and radio stations seek soundbites from him whenever there is some momentous event. I have spent many hours with Lane on the golf course and in our homes. We share a love for single malt scotch and spicy food. He often quotes Shakespeare to me, usually from his favorite Crispin Day speech from Henry V, that man who enjoys being king, obviously. I am proud to call him my friend. So here he is, my colleague and fellow curmudgeon, Lane Crothers.
Yeah, they changed the script on me.
Well, thank you very much. I thank you very much for those kind introductions. I would point out to both my introducers that I get to go last, which therefore, of course, means that I win. And so it is, in fact, my very great honor to be here tonight. Over my 17 years at Illinois State University, I've had the chance to learn that this campus is filled with a remarkably large number of very talented faculty, students, and staff, both in the university and across the community at large. If you were to glance through the names of some of the past arts and sciences lecturers, you'd discover that they, in fact, are some of the very best that Illinois State University has to offer. to steal one of the Britishisms I picked up, perhaps at Lord's, I am, in fact, a bit gobsmacked that my name gets to be added to that list. I'm here tonight to talk about the Tea Party. At one level, this isn't particularly surprising. The Tea Party movement has blossomed into a powerful political force over the last 2 years, and I have a long-standing interest in right-wing and right-leaning social movements. As I'll discuss later in this talk, I see the Tea Party as a logical, if not necessarily inevitable, extension of American political culture's values, norms, ideals, and social practices. The Tea Party, like it or not, is a profoundly American phenomenon. It's us, or at least one version of us. On the other hand, analysis of the Tea Party is limited by one simple fact. The Tea Party doesn't exist. It's a small problem. I can work my way around it, don't worry. That is, while I can go visit the headquarters of the Democratic and Republican parties, I can't go find Tea Party HQ. There are people out there who are generally understood to be Tea Partiers, but no one is authorized to speak for the Tea Party. That said, it's pretty hard to argue that something called the Tea Party doesn't exist, at least in inchoate, developing form. My task tonight, if I can be said to have a task, is to answer the question, why has the Tea Party risen now with the members and ideals that it has? I hope, before our time ends, to answer this question with a broader answer than is usually bandied about on blogs and television and the squawking talking heads that seem to shape and represent so much political discourse today. As will become clear, I think that there are layers of answers to this question. Some are economic, some cultural, some political. The phenomenon is simply too big to be reduced to some equation like they hate Obama because they're racists or they're dupes of big business. These things might be true for some Tea Partiers, of course, but they're not the whole story. But first, a note on language. My rule of thumb when addressing political topics is to call people that which they wish to be called. The politics of naming are embedded in the fraught politics of identity, and I don't wish to get caught up in the effort to demean or valorize a group by imposing my chosen name on them. Accordingly, tonight you'll hear things like Tea Party members, Tea Party sympathizers, and Tea Partiers from me, as that's as close as I can come to an understanding of what such persons wish to be called. In a moment of weakness, I might go to Tea Partyists, which is a term I haven't really heard from anyone, but it's something that Jeremy Clarkson, a BBC presenter for the absolutely brilliant show Top Gear, would say. What you won't hear from me tonight, other than this one time, is teabagger. A term that critics have coined to link an apparently demeaning sexual practice to the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party and the associated signs, they have the best signs. This was just fun. I'll be honest with you about that. So first things first, what the heck is the Tea Party? Who are these people and what do they want? To start from the demographics, it will surprise no one to learn that survey research has found that, in general, Tea Partyists are white. They're middle-aged and older. They're middle class. They tend to be fiscally conservative, meaning that they say they would prefer to balance the budget through spending cuts rather than tax increases. Notably, few are culture warriors, meaning that, for the most part, Tea Partiers don't seem to care as much about issues of abortion or religion or gay marriage as conservative Republicans have for the last 20 years or so. They are, in other words, fairly ordinary Americans who've become mobilized to political action. Indeed, in many ways, what's most interesting and most surprising about the Tea Partiers is the fact that they're engaged and active at all. For much of American history, to steal from Richard Nixon, they've seemed a silent majority. In terms of what they want, well, that's a bit harder of a question to answer. I think I can actually do a better job telling you what they don't want than I can telling you what they actually do want. This, I think, is true for Tea Partiers themselves. For example, Tea Party members and certain sympathizers certainly believe they're overtaxed. That's what it means, right? You get that, right? They believe that government has grown too powerful and is too invasive of citizens' private choices. They sense that the nation's economic books are out of balance and that too many people receive benefits they don't deserve from the pockets of people who have jobs and pay taxes. Tea Partiers appear to believe that an unaccountable elite has rigged the political and economic system such that big banks get bailouts while ordinary homeowners get tossed out. They also wonder if the United States will continue to exist in the form they remember, however inaccurately, or if it will change in response to pressures of immigration, globalization, and the demands of an evolving international legal community. Now, it should be stated up front that none of these concerns are radical or surprising. The United States was, in many ways, a nation formed in a tax revolt. Resistance to taxes is core to this nation's DNA. The federal government's size and authority has, in fact, grown in staggering degrees in the last 120 years. Likewise, the United States has, in fact, gone on a 30-year-long, low-tax, high-spending spree that swelled the national debt from $3 trillion in 1980 to $14 trillion in 2010. And that's in adjusted dollars. Bankers are now giving themselves unspeakable bonuses and self-congratulation for their self-asserted brilliance at making money on the 0% loans you and I offered them as part of their bailout packages. Illegal immigration is real and has real social and political consequences. And while I don't think that any of us need to worry about Sharia law coming to the United States anytime soon, globalization does bring ideas and values that challenge established norms and social practices into American lives and cultures. None of this is made up. It's perfectly okay to think that Tea Partiers are wrong to be bothered by these things, but that doesn't mean they're not really happening, or that it's actually wrong for Tea Partiers to be bothered by these things. Tea Partiers are middle-class, middle-aged Americans with a grievance, and taking full rights of their First Amendment rights, they're petitioning government for the redress of those grievances. Now, as it happens, I'm not particularly interested in who the Tea Partiers are, nor am I particularly interested in the content of their political claims. In other words, I'm not going to commit political science in front of you tonight. I'm not going to explain how Tea Party demographics line up with Tea Party politics. Instead, what I'm really interested in are the reasons that so many Americans find the Tea Party's ideals and values meaningful in their own lives. Now, don't get me wrong. I have strong opinions, this will not shock you to hear, about both the problems Tea Partiers have identified as important to them and about the solutions to these problems that Tea Partiers offer. For example, I, like many, find their sudden concern about deficits run up under President Obama suspect, given their silence about the massive deficits run up under the Republican-run government from 2001 to 2007. Just for convenience's sake here, blue is Democrat, red is Republican, with the one exception that we should at least acknowledge, which is this stops at 2009. If it went to 2010, it would make it to the very top line. In addition, I'm hard-pressed to explain how slashing social programs will lead to anything other than more problems and more difficulties than maintaining them will. And given the declining infrastructure we see all around us, I can't really figure out how failing to fund the maintenance and constructions of bridges and roads and schools will lead us to anything other than more decline and more decay. In short, I think Tea Partiers have both misdiagnosed the problems America faces and have offered misbegotten solutions to these concerns. But my opinions matter not in the least to Tea Partiers and their sympathizers. That is, even if I'm right, and the Tea Party would seriously harm America if it were to come to power, it would still be true that lots of Americans like the Tea Party and want to see it succeed. My question is, why? So let's turn to the beginning. If the Tea Party movement can be said to have a beginning, it would be February 19th, 2009. It's amazing to be able to date things like this, but nonetheless. On that day, just a month after Barack Obama came to office, CNBC business commentator Rick Santelli offered a now famous, or perhaps infamous, rant on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Responding to a discussion about the Obama administration's proposal to promote mortgage modifications as a tool to deal with the financial crisis, Santelli opined, "The new administration is big on computers and technology. How about this, Mr. President, new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages?" I'm not doing the sneer right either. He then turned to the traders on the floor behind him and asked, "How many people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgages that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills?" After hearing their cries of "No, no," Santelli continued saying, "It's time for another Tea Party. What we are doing in this country will make Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin roll over in their graves." One of the most abused images in all of the history of politics, by the way. Those guys never stop spinning. There is, of course, much missing in this rant. In Santelli's view, the economic crisis was caused by the manifold homebuyers who bought more house than they could afford. When these profligate persons subsequently failed to meet their mortgage payments, the economy collapsed. And since they overreached in their home buying decisions and their irresponsibility caused the economic collapse, any efforts to help mortgagees out of the mess they had made constituted an immoral act, rewarding bad behavior. Notably, the deep causes of the financial crisis are nowhere to be found in this complaint. Santelli made no mention of the roles played by collateralized debt obligations, credit default swaps, no income verification mortgages, or fraudulent credit practices, all masked by elaborate financial instruments, in causing the economic collapse. Indeed, Santelli might not even have known of all of these factors at the time of his rant. But that ignorance has played no factor at all in the rise of the Tea Party movement. Instead, Santelli's comments resonated across the nation, and a new movement was born. Of course, any analysis of the making of the Tea Party that consisted of "Thus Spake Santelli" would inevitably and appropriately be laughed out of any peer review committee. Even acknowledging the one structural advantage he had in establishing a cultural meme compared to most of the rest of us, he had access to a television network that replayed his comments time and again. It should be remembered that talk television, like talk radio in the internet blogosphere, is filled with thousands and hundreds of thousands of claims, artfully stated comments, and snarky asides that might come to public consciousness, but don't. That his did speaks to some deeper elements in American political life. As it happens, social movements do not arise spontaneously. Someone has to do the work of creating a site, calling meetings, and bugging people to get them to participate. In other words, movements need leaders, and new movements need entrepreneurial leaders who can shape the emergent political group. Notably, in the early days of the Tea Party movement, many on the left viewed these groups as nothing more than astroturf phenomenon, meaning that they were seen as little more than front organizations bought and paid for by business and conservative groups. The notion was that the groups did not represent the real or authentic opinions of some segment of the American people. Rather, they were as fake as plastic grass, and so constituted nothing for opponents to worry about. I love that picture. It's in New Zealand. I wish it was in America, but nonetheless. Somebody had to think to do that. I kind of find that cool, but anyway. Now, it may well be that liberals and progressives were right about this, that business and conservative groups subsidized the early days of the movement. But I'm not sure that really matters. After all, if you look at the early days of the Tea Party movement, you find that the rallies were organized in local communities. Local people adopted the teabag hat and the Tea Party name and found others who were inspired by these symbols. Now, these early rallies were certainly aided and abetted by modern means of communication. Fox News' aggressive coverage of Tea Party events helped early leaders find each other and helped build a brand image that others could adopt in labeling themselves Tea Partiers. Likewise, social networking services simplified the process of organizing the Tea Party movement. To borrow a concept from economics, services like Facebook and Twitter reduced the opportunity costs of forming and maintaining the Tea Party. However, while it is true that if Facebook was a country, it would be the third most populous country in the world, the order would be China, India, Facebook, and the United States. As I'll discuss throughout this talk, the ideals, values, economic conditions, and political myths that undergird the Tea Party movement are deeply embedded features of American political life. Things like Fox News and social networks obviously facilitated the rise of the Tea Party, but they did not cause it. Instead, entrepreneurial leaders exploited the tools available to them to link broad social and political tensions with iconic American images to create the Tea Party movement. Now, before moving on, I want to take a minute here to address the elephant in the room, race. Many liberals and progressives have argued that a core motivating factor in the rise of the Tea Party movement has been race. They don't like Obama, such activists insist, because he's black. As it happens, I imagine that there are some number of racists in the Tea Party movement. This, it seems to me, is because there are some number of racists in America. Moreover, like all opposition movements, the Tea Party has surely attracted its share of extremists, radicals, and colorful people. Exactly the kind of people, it should be noted, that television cameras and internet blogs love to focus on, highlight, and almost always overplay the importance of. Think drag queens at gay rights parades. So do I think it was easier for some in the Tea Party movement to mobilize against Obama's agenda because Obama is black than it would have been had, say, Joe Biden been elected president to do almost exactly the same thing? Absolutely. But I imagine we'd be talking about gender issues instead of race ones had Hillary Clinton been elected. So do I think that race alone plays an overwhelmingly powerful role in explaining the rise and character of the Tea Party? No. The Tea Party movement is deeper than AstroTurf and more than just racism. It would be convenient, at least for liberals and progressives, if the Tea Party were nothing more than the post-Ayn Rand rantings of Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck. But it's not. Now, notably, leaders need followers. In other words, why did Santilli's rant find an audience prepared to respond? When seeking to answer this question, it is important to remember that the Tea Party movement emerged in the context of a significant economic crisis. The United States, and the rest of the world for that matter, came as close to a depression as the world had come in nearly 80 years. Periods of great financial stress are well known to feed periods of social unrest and unease. It's common for anti-immigrant sentiments to flourish in economic crises, for example. People looking for an explanation of the crisis regularly scapegoat, and cultural others are an easy and seemingly inevitable target of social opprobrium. Someone or something has to account for the crisis, and so people look around for who to blame. For Tea Partiers, at least two groups seem to have emerged as culpable for what has come to be known as the Great Recession: government and the bankers. In one Tea Party complaint, the recession was caused by a cabal of bankers who worked with a coterie of paid-off congresspeople and bureaucratic non-regulators to construct a system that favored the interests of the bankers against the interests of the powerful, or sorry, of the people, whatever that means. It's kind of hard to find the people sometimes. In this, notably, Tea Partiers offer a complaint about the causes of the Great Recession similar to that asserted by many liberals and progressives. They sensed that the system was co-opted by the powerful and rules were written to the benefit of the elite. And you have here a mashup of signs of both Tea Party signs and also anti-G20 globalization signs by various anarchist groups. Sorry that one of them's kind of rude, but so are the anarchists, so it all works out. However, while Tea Partiers might agree with liberals and progressives in their diagnoses of what caused the Great Recession, they disagree vigorously on what ought to be done about it. Liberals and progressives see the failure of the regulatory state to rein in the excesses of predatory capitalism as a matter of will. The state chose to favor the interests of the powerful over those of the weak, but properly managed, the balance could be restruck in favor of ordinary citizens. The problem is one of administration, not character. For Tea Partyists, by contrast, the problem lies in the fact that elites now dominate every aspect of social and political life. To offer one quick example, the last job Hank Paulson, George W. Bush's Secretary of the Treasury, had before becoming Treasury Secretary was, you didn't know there was going to be a pop quiz, did you? Chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. His policy recommendation for getting the United States out of its economic crisis? Give Goldman Sachs and the other major investment banks profound amounts of money. Notably, his successor, Timothy Geithner, was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York before becoming Treasury Secretary. His recommendation for getting the United States out of its economic crisis? Keep giving Goldman Sachs and the other major investment banks profound amounts of money. It seems to me that many liberals and progressives have misapprehended the legitimate anger that many Americans, not just Tea Partiers, feel about this elite takeover of American political and social life. It wasn't ordinary Americans who caused the recession, after all. The crisis happened after the best and the brightest invented various mathematical models that they believed or fantasized would eliminate risk from the financial system. Such elites also concocted the theoretical absurdity that was Milton Friedman's and Alan Greenspan's notions of transparent markets that did not need regulation. It wasn't small businessmen like my father who invented mark-to-market accounting schemes that allowed companies to book profits today on derivatives they bought for future sale. It was the masters of the universe on Wall Street and the City of London who did that. And it wasn't the graduates of Illinois State University or Iowa State University or Indiana State University who created the overleveraged Ponzi scheme that collapsed in the fall of 2008. If you know anything about it, they were leveraged at 30-to-1 rates. That's a Ponzi scheme. It was the graduates of Harvard and MIT and Dartmouth and Chicago who managed the remarkable feat of bleeding a decade's worth of economic growth out of the American economy in less than 6 months. But who did both the Bush and Obama administrations turn to solve this crisis? The elites from Harvard and MIT and Dartmouth and Chicago. Importantly, this anti-elite sentiment is inherently anti-government, or at least anti-modern government. One of the distinctive features of modern government is the use of experts to manage various programs implemented across public life. After all, most of us want experts to decide whether prescription drugs are safe, or the food supply is safe, or the water supply is safe, or what the best method is to land people on the moon and return them safely to the Earth. Accordingly, as government programs proliferated to ensure safe drugs and food and water and to land people on the moon and do everything else it is the government does these days, we ceded more and more of our democratic power to shape government to the regulatory authority of the administrative state. We decided we didn't want to set water safety standards by popular vote, and so we allow bureaucrats to set them for us. We just pay the bill. Now, as it happens, I'm not really opposed to this system. I really, really don't want my fellow citizens deciding how safe my water is to drink based on what level of cleanliness they're willing to pay for. But imagine that millions of American children were harmed in a water crisis. Imagine that water regulators and water company executives and their children all went to the same elite schools and had known or known of each other for most of their lives. Imagine that there was a staggering pattern of payoffs, we call them campaign contributions, and other financial arrangements between policymakers and water regulators. And consider what you would think if you discovered that the water regulators who had allowed your children to be poisoned had been rotating into and out of government on a regular basis, regulating those they had just worked for and expected to work for again. My guess is that you'd be pretty pissed. And that you'd be pretty skeptical of the notion that government was the solution or that government should be trusted to deal with these complex matters for you. But of course, you don't really have to imagine any of this. After all, I've just described the regulatory environment of the American financial system for at least the last 20 years. So where liberals and progressives tend to shout, more regulations, Tea Partiers seem to say, why should we trust you this time? Of such stuff was the Tea Party born. Now, I should note here that this anti-elite sentiment is not just inherently anti-big government. It's also inherently anti-big business. It seems clear to me that at some level, Tea Partiers are torn between distrust of big business and distrust of big government. So why, then, does the Tea Party seem so much more angry at government than it does at big business? It seems to me that there are at least two major streams of recent history that have encouraged Tea Party activists to channel their rage at government rather than at business, or at least not as much at business. The first of these is the emergence of an anti-government ideology as a core principle of a major American political party, the Republicans, in case you weren't sure, in the 30 years since Ronald Reagan became president. If there's a single statement that seems to summarize many Americans' attitudes towards government these days, it's Ronald Reagan's comment in his first inaugural address that, in this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. If America was in decline, Reagan insisted, it was the government's fault. Regulations hampered business. Taxes crushed innovation. Modern theories of welfare led to the poverty dens of mega housing projects and to a cycle of permanent dependency of the poor on government handouts. Meanwhile, government was failing to undertake the one thing it clearly ought to undertake, national defense. America was in a crisis that was government's fault. It was plainly ridiculous to expect government to fix it. Now, while this statement and the ideology that undergirds it has been more effective as a campaign slogan than it has as a governing philosophy, it nonetheless has shaped much of the politics of the last 30 years. Since 1980, Democrats have been somewhat more pro-government than Republicans have been, but both parties have basically accepted the rhetorical premise that less government is better than more government. Really, until President Obama's election in 2008, and frankly, in terms of the deal-making he's making right now, he's gone back to that notion. After all, it was Bill Clinton, an allegedly liberal Democrat, who declared the era of big government is over in a January 1996 radio address. And it was Bill Clinton, an allegedly liberal Democrat, who sponsored policies to end welfare as we know it, which of course he did. Reagan's ideas have likewise dominated American economic and tax policy. For example, since Ronald Reagan's election, the United States has significantly reduced income tax rates. It's reduced regulations on businesses. The notion that business can, in pretty much all cases, provide goods and services more efficiently and more effectively than government agencies can, has become a central tenet of political life. So is the claim that reduced income and capital gains taxes and reduced regulations will inevitably lead to more economic growth and reduced deficits. For Tea Partiers, it doesn't really matter whether or not these claims are true. As it happens, there's a lot of evidence that they're not. 1980, it is worth pointing out, is right there. That's 80. Maybe this thing isn't working too well. I don't know. It's a thought, anyway. Similarly, it doesn't matter that Reagan himself never came close to living up to the standards his followers attribute to him. Instead, the Tea Party has adopted Ronald Reagan as a saint. Do you get this? The hat's a halo. You got that right. His rhetoric is word. Thus, while the movement might have been anti-big business, it's become substantially more anti-big government. Government, not business, is seen to be the problem. So it's government that must be constrained. Now, a second thing that's clearly encouraged the rise of the Tea Party as an anti-government movement is the federal government's remarkable expansion of power over the last decade. A simple list of the major federal government initiatives and power realignments of the last 10 years fairly boggles the mind, especially since many of them were initiated and implemented by allegedly conservative anti-government Republicans. No Child Left Behind, the Patriot Act, NSA screening of every cell phone call and email into and out of the United States, federal spying on U.S. citizens, Guantanamo, torture, Afghanistan, Iraq, the TSA, the theory of the unitary executive by which the Bush administration claimed that congressional oversight of its war-making activities was illegal, meaning that the Bush administration claimed it could do whatever it wanted in the war against terror. Massive budget deficits, Medicare prescription drug reform, the bank bailout. Frankly, compared to these arrogations of executive and federal authority, the Obama administration's actions seem comparatively paltry. Extending the bank bailout, the auto bailout, the stimulus, healthcare reform. But this expansion of the federal government's power shouldn't be seen, or shouldn't only be seen, through a partisan lens. The point isn't whether Bush was worse than Obama. Rather, for the Tea Party, the problem is one of accretion. Tea Partiers sense that, taken together, all these changes have profoundly restructured the relations of power of American government. It's clear that many Tea Partiers believe that after all the Bush-era excesses, the federal government has reached the saturation point and that the United States can't take any more. This analogy may be too simplistic and the United States may not actually be at the saturation point, but that's not the issue. For many Tea Partiers, the point is they're done. They're exhausted. It's time to stop. As I continue my exploration of the question, why the Tea Party, I want to suggest that there's at least one deep economic reason why the Tea Party movement has risen at this time. The United States' 30-year-long process of transferring wealth from the middle class to the rich. Over the last 30 years, economic changes like globalization and increased pressure for quarterly profits have combined to create an economy in which the relative wealth of most Americans has stayed the same or gotten worse, even as they've worked harder and harder. It's true that people in the top income groups have done very well over the last 30 years. Indeed, people at the very top have done phenomenally well. But most Americans have not. People at the lower income strata have simply fallen behind. Indeed, people at the bottom of the spectrum have seen their economic positions collapse, especially if one factors things like reductions in social welfare programs, declining support for mass transit systems, and reduced financial aid for higher education into the economic equation. By 2010, income inequality in the United States had become more extreme than it had been in nearly a century. Unfortunately, government tax policy over the last 30 years has exacerbated this marginalization of the middle and working classes. The reason is fairly simple. The fact that the U.S. income tax system is progressive means that better off people pay the bulk of the income taxes that government collects. The thing is the United States has gone on its 30-year path of cutting income taxes, it hasn't actually cut the amount of money it spends on the programs it funds, at least not in the aggregate. Instead, government spending on all programs has more than doubled in just the last 13 years. Now, don't get me wrong, we've shifted spending around. For example, we spend more money on retirees and on the military than we used to, even as we've slashed support for higher education and infrastructure maintenance and repair. But we spend a lot more money than we used to. In order to replace the taxes it used to collect from high-income people, government has increased an array of other taxes to try to meet its bills. Property taxes, sales taxes, and sin taxes have all gone up. States have sought to fill their budget gaps with lotteries, tuition and fee increases for government services, and reduced support for programs aimed at the poor. Government has also borrowed lots of money. And interest on the debt is a form of taxation. By borrowing money today, we commit future funds to pay off those loans. Funds that might have been used to subsidize roads or schools or healthcare or tax cuts. Notably, these taxes disproportionately affect the middle and working classes. Indeed, the average middle class person today pays a higher percentage of their earnings in all kinds of taxes than he or she did 30 years ago, even as the relative tax burden on the wealthy has gone down dramatically. In other words, in transferring wealth to the upper class, American tax policy is draining the pocketbooks of its great middle. Why does this matter? Well, first, as the distribution of wealth has shifted in the U.S., people in the middle class have had a harder and harder time meeting their bills, educating their children, and doing the things that middle class Americans have always figured they were going to be able to do. Many have responded by taking on ever higher levels of debt, often refinancing their homes to enable them to pay off what they owe, something they can't do right now. Such debt mirrors the national debt and feeds a sense that it's all gone too far, that we've hit the saturation point. In addition, the increased burden on the middle class to fund government's operations informs Tea Party rhetoric about eliminating or seriously reducing social welfare programs and public pensions. Why, Tea Partiers ask, should those of us struggling to live decent lives and meet our commitments continue to subsidize the lives of people who don't deserve our support? Their answer, of course, is that we shouldn't. And so they urge cuts to programs like welfare and pensions as a way to balance the budget. For 30 years now, the United States has transferred wealth up the economic spectrum, squeezing more and more out of the middle and working classes. Ironically, much of this work has occurred with the acquiescence and even the active support of the very middle class that was being gutted. In any case, whatever the cause, the effect has been to create a world in which many of the middle class people who form the core of the Tea Party movement are feeling overwhelmed and worn out. The middle class has voted itself into the ground. For many, the Tea Party seems like the only reasonable alternative. The last theme I want to articulate today as I seek to answer the question of why the Tea Party has risen is cultural. I want to take the Tea Party name seriously. While critics may mock the Tea Party with sexual slurs or comments about members' seeming inability to spell, assuming the evidence isn't photoshopped, and we do have to be honest, it could very well be photoshopped, but I don't think so. I'm one of those people who like, walk, as a faculty person, I like walk into public spaces and see a misspelled sign, and by God, I want to change the spelling right there. The notion of a Tea Party seems to matter a great deal to Tea Party supporters. Why? In myth, the Boston Tea Partiers tossed tea into Boston Harbor to protest taxation without representation. Their actions, along with those of countless other brave Americans, are seen to have brought forth a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, it doesn't really matter if this myth is true. At best, the national memory of the Boston Tea Party is incomplete. As it happens, the Boston Tea Partiers were in part angry that the British East India, that the British had recently reduced taxes on tea imported by the British East India Company. This tax break made imported tea cheaper, making it competitive with tea that was smuggled into the American colonies in violation of the East India Company's monopoly. Smuggling is a deeply embedded American tradition. And I believe the biggest tea smuggler in the United States was John Hancock. Big signature at the bottom of the declaration. He was a merchant fleet owner. In other words, the Boston Tea Party was in part a pro-smuggler protest against a tax decrease. Not exactly the story the modern Tea Party wants you to think about. It likewise doesn't matter if the myth that the revolution was won by citizen soldiers who spontaneously left their homes and fought off the world's most powerful empire is really true or not. It's not. Instead, what matters for Tea Partiers is the myth that citizen warriors can come out of their homes and take to the streets and transform the world. Like the Boston Tea Partiers before them, or at least like the Boston Tea Partiers they imagined before them, modern Tea Partiers believe that in resisting taxation, they are American patriots, restoring a world in which individuals band together to make governments that are limited in rights respecting, or to break governments that go too far. Of course, the intensity of their faith in this myth does blind some Tea Partiers to the implications of some of their rhetoric. As some Tea Partiers have adopted the rhetoric of 1775, they've suggested, sometimes implicitly, sometimes explicitly, that the current existing government of the United States is tyrannical. Cries like, "We need to take our country back," seem to be more than perfectly legitimate campaign rally appeals. Instead, they seem to derive from a sense that there's something fundamentally wrong with American politics today. Claims that federal programs like Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, and the new health care law are unconstitutional because they're not expressly defined in the Constitution is of a similar point. And the birther movement, which is not necessarily a core Tea Party element, but which found support of 51% of likely Republican primary voters in a recent poll, and I'm not making that number up, is similarly informed by a sense that the nation has been perverted. Pop quiz. If he's born in Kenya, he's still a U.S. citizen because his mother was. Sorry. These rhetorical excesses aside, the fact is the Tea Party makes, that even when it's, some of its members talk nonsense, the Tea Party makes sense in America. The notion of a Tea Party taps into longstanding American skepticism about taxes. It also draws life from American political culture's deeply embedded fear of strong central government. Accordingly, like it or not, the Tea Party is as American as baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet. My generation gets that joke. The students have no idea. Of course, Louis Chevrolet was a real person. He was from Switzerland. Yeah. Which is why this is all quite complicated. So how do I sum up? I don't like the Tea Party, but I think I get it. One group of Americans has decided that they're angry at the shape of U.S. politics today. They've linked core American political symbols with contemporary social, political, and economic tensions and formed a movement that offers both a diagnosis of the nation's ills and a nascent plan to overcome the country's problems. And while I personally think their plans neither actually represent the values they claim to honor, nor will actually work to achieve the goals they claim to value, that's not the point. The Tea Party makes sense in American politics and culture, and millions of Americans find it meaningful and important, in their own lives. Perhaps the best way I can conclude is to offer some thoughts about whether the Tea Party. Will it be a long-term force in American politics, or will it fade as so many other movements have faded before it? There's an argument to be made that the Tea Party is going to have a permanent long-term effect on American politics. In part, this is the result of momentum. We are in a Tea Party moment. There's a sense among lots of Republicans and not a few Democrats that one needs to get on board to not be swept aside. Moreover, the choices we make today about how to deal with budget deficits and education reform and infrastructure and all the other things that government does will surely influence American politics well into the future. In shaping the universe of politically possible responses to our problems today, the Tea Party is undoubtedly setting the table for choices that future leaders will have to make. That said, it should be noted that the odds are stacked against the Tea Party. While emerging social protest movements always seem like they're going to change the world, in time, politics change and the ideas and values that seem so crucial in one political moment become less relevant in another. The Tea Party will have to surf this inevitable change if it wishes to survive. In addition, the Tea Party has to win across several more election cycles. It's certainly had an impressive run for the last 18 months. But the genius of the American constitutional system is that in order to take control of the polity, one's ideas and candidates have to win elections for several years. And this, it turns out, is hard. As the recent protests against and recall efforts to undo Governor Scott Walker's Tea Party-informed union-busting activities in Wisconsin attest. There's also the matter of the Republican Party's emerging civil war. Tea Party Republicans are different from other conservatively minded Republicans. They are, for example, much, much less willing to compromise on budget matters. This tension has manifested itself in, among other things, the struggle Speaker of the House John Boehner has had to turn his substantial Republican majority into an actual legislative agenda. It also portends a difficult primary season for the Republicans as the 2012 presidential season starts. The Tea Party movement will also need to offer a coherent, practical plan for dealing with the problems its members bemoan. Representative Paul Ryan's recent proposal aside, and it's not going anywhere, Tea Partiers have so far concentrated their plans to balance the budget on the 12% of U.S. spending that's in the category of non-security discretionary spending. That's a graph of all the discretionary spending in the United States, 58% of which is military. Everything else makes up 12% of the U.S. budget. But it turns out that if you cut every program out of the U.S. budget right now, except for defense, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt, the United States would still run a deficit this year. Those five programs make up 68% of the U.S. budget. Once you once heard a joke recently, but the joke was, if you want to know what the United States is, it's a social insurance company with a large standing army. Thus, solving the United States' budget woes will take sacrifice from all parts of the system. We'll face budget cuts to privileged programs like Social Security, Medicare, and defense. We'll need to enact significant tax increases. We'll need to accept that we financed an unsustainable standard of living with an increasingly unsustainable level of debt. But none of that's an easy sell. It's pretty hard to win votes on the "your life is going to get worse" platform. Just ask Jimmy Carter. Indeed, if anything, we've been going the other way. The recent extension of the Bush tax cuts, an extension passed in the immediate aftermath of the apparent Tea Party triumph in the elections last November, suggests that for all the passions of this Tea Party moment, Americans aren't yet willing to face the music and accept they can't have all the programs they want without paying taxes to support them. Something, whether tax increases or program cuts to things they care about deeply or both, has to give. And right now, no one in America is giving. What you see here is a graph of Republicans and Democrats. Republicans red, Democrats blue, and the line in the middle is 50%. So do you oppose tax cuts in these, or program cuts in these various areas? Do more than 50% or less than 50% oppose cuts? And the only one that more than 50% of even Republicans are willing to cut is aid to the world's needy. And you can't balance the U.S. budget out of aid to the women of the world's needy. Got some big news for you here. In the end, all I can really say is that the Tea Party movement may not have peaked yet. Indeed, last fall, its supporters were successful in electing lots of sympathetic politicians at all levels of government. The movement now has to survive practical politics, political frustrations, and attempts at co-optation. Thus, while the Tea Party may not be over, its members may well want, or even need, to begin to look at their watches. In America, social movements usually cool like the remnants of after-dinner tea. We can only hope. Thank you. Thank you very much. I was half hoping there would be Tea Party people here with signs and stuff, and that was kind of half my fantasy here. So, but please, I'm more than, yes, Brian.
Would the Tea Party have been born if John McCain had been elected president?
You know, I had a riff in this talk about that at one point in time, and as I kept reading it, it kept getting longer and longer and longer, that particular riff had to go. I personally am capable of standing here and talking for 2 hours, but I didn't think you guys would put up with it. You know, I'm not sure. I think parts of it would have. I don't think that it wouldn't have been as easy to form, and I don't think it would have been as broad. But some of what had to happen, the TARP bailout, I can't imagine any president letting the car companies collapse. It just seems impossible to imagine letting that happen. And thus, I think there would have been a certain amount of blowback. I do think the race issue is a context. I don't mean to dismiss that entirely as a context. And certainly then with a health care proposal that would not have happened, it intensified. But yeah, I absolutely think there would have been at least some version of that movement out there. Yeah, Bruce.
Just this morning I heard, and I don't remember the exact percentage, but some large, more than 50% of the Tea Party seemed to support Donald Trump. This goes to your question of the longevity of the movement, and it made me think about Ross Perot's run.
Right.
And then the bumper stickers that said Ross for Boss. And I'm wondering, is right. this a continuation of the sort of people who supported Ross Perot and
Sure. Sure, although I'll give Ross Perot credit that I don't give Donald Trump, which is, first of all, I don't think he's been bankrupt multiple times, but and I don't think he's been married 3 times either. Be very careful. Donald Trump is a twice divorced, 3 times married, multiply bankrupt germaphobe who doesn't like to shake people's hands. This man is not going to get through Iowa and New Hampshire. This man couldn't get through President Bowman's day, right? And so, I mean, the prospects of a Donald Trump presidency are, in fact, not going to make me run in front of a bus. The question, of course, is it in the Perot category? And actually, Perot had an actual serious plan about thinking about these budget matters, and I'm not sure I agreed with it, but he at least had it there. What Trump's got is the willingness to say anything that gets him on TV. And interestingly enough, there's an absolutely clear correlation. The more stupid things he says, the higher the ratings for The Apprentice are. And just saw it today, in fact, that if... He was asked in 2008 when he was thinking about running for president why, and his answer was, because that way I can raise the rents. It's a little bit of our YouTube culture after all, but yeah. Did they overthrow the capitalist system? You know,
forcing George Bush to be a socialist.
Sure. Well, first of all, we don't have a pure capitalist system to begin with. I mean, it's a hybrid system. It's been a hybrid system. All the advanced world, all the advanced democracies, the technologically, economically advanced democracies run hybrid systems. Ours is more capitalist than most of the others are. So that's step number one. No, absolutely. No, there's no question of that. The argument then is did the banks kind of overthrow capitalism and go to pure socialism? In a way, yes, of course, that's absolutely true. In another way, again, I've tried to wrestle with that because in the moment, what's your alternative? Can you actually let the global banking system collapse? Where I'm frustrated, and I'm sure you are as well, is that we've not passed a single meaningful reform to that process in the 3 years since. And when there used to be 30 banks that were too big to fail, now there's 10. That's actually much more frustrating to me in that sense. So. Right, and that's the Chinese debt question is an interesting one. We saw that commercial during the campaign ad, right, with suddenly China took us over or whatever else. That was a fascinating commercial, I must say, on several different levels. It is worth pointing out that the United States can actually pay China's debt tomorrow. We can go and print an $11 trillion bill and hand it to them. Right? We can. Only country in the world that can do that. We can print an $11 trillion bill and hand it to them. The price of bread tomorrow will be $175,000 a loaf. You'll set tuition rates somewhere around $5 million a year. But we can do it. And that's a huge power that changes. I just don't see that as quite the coercive relationship that some do. It's a problem. I'm not trying to suggest that it's not. I don't see it as quite the power and coercion that others do for that reason. That's a great question because, of course, the long-term demographics are not in favor of the middle-aged, middle-class white people. I wish to be clear about this. At the early days of the Tea Party movement, let me take a detour before I get to that specific question. People on the left, progressives and liberals, often dismissed the Tea Party movement because it was white, middle-aged, middle-class people. Well, I'm sorry, but as a white, middle-class, middle-aged man, I don't have a problem with white, middle-class, middle-aged people. We're not evil just because we exist. Some of us have been profoundly evil and stupid in our lives. That's absolutely true. I hope I haven't been one of them. So, first of all, there's nothing wrong with having these positions. There's nothing wrong with advancing them. Right now, you're having a movement that's strongly captured by its ideological extreme. Such movements tend to do two things. They tend to flare and be crushed because they don't get the support they need, or they tend to moderate. Which way they're going, it's very hard to tell in the middle of it. It's very early days. Certainly the movement itself, in terms of the support for the Tea Party movement, has declined in general, even among people who call themselves Tea Partiers. The intensity has gone down, in part because they won the House election. They don't have to be as afraid of the government anymore because they're, like, partially in charge of it. Do I imagine, therefore, demographically that they... That's an interesting one, right? Because the Republicans, in general, where's this anti-immigration, anti-Hispanic stuff coming from? You're like, guys, if you looked at the math... In fact, I had an occasion many, many years ago. You were there, Brian, when we were in that restaurant in Rockford. And they were running, the Northern Illinois Hispanic Republican Association was having a meeting. And they actually beamed in. Were you there, Kim? I think you were there, too. You were there, too. And they beamed in a representative from the National Republican Party and had this talk about, and in many ways, Hispanics are inherently Republican-leaning. They're much more conservative Catholics than most American Catholics are. They have much more established patterns of traditional kind of family relationships than, if you will, mainstream white Catholics are. But then in the next breath, they go off and say, oh, yeah, they're all illegal, and we got to build a wall and, like, shoot them. You're like, wow. Wherever they're getting their political advice, I can imagine both paths. I think they're in trouble in the long term. I would agree with that. But it's entertaining in any case. I get a great job. It's very entertaining, if nothing else. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Whether you like them or not, though, I think one of the things that makes this country great is that people can go on protests in the street and not being shot and killed by your government. But a lot of things, we do throw race into a lot of things. And I just wanted to clarify, just so I make sure I'm understanding this right. The birther thing seems to me foolish. But anyways, wasn't that, though, originally started with Hillary Clinton's presidential race? And then wasn't also John McCain's birth certificate also...
Sure. The Hillary Clinton thing is now, if you go to Snopes.com, the Hillary Clinton thing has been pushed. That's gone. That's not true. It's the explanation that's come subsequently.
No, I know it's not true. I'm saying that...
No, what I'm saying is the notion that Hillary Clinton's campaign started it, I believe, has been demonstrated to be false. I think that's true. In terms of John McCain, absolutely. In fact, Donald Trump, to go back to that question, is now going on television saying you have to be born in the United States. Well, in fact, then John McCain cannot have been president of the United States because he was born in Panama. In fact, you don't have to be born in the United States. You can be born to U.S. citizens or even a U.S. citizen. So there's no question that the daily politics of a campaign are nasty, brutish, and longer than we wish they were. Mr. Hobbs on political campaigns was wrong. One of the critiques that I often offer of the system is that once you introduce a tactic, that tactic becomes normalized, right? So whether it's the impeachment of Bill Clinton because you don't like his sexual life, or it's the firing of judges because they don't fit your political profile, that becomes increasingly common. What's changed is the internet. What's changed is the speed and instant dissemination, and that many, many years ago now, I once got a paper, this kind of symbolizes this for me, I once got a paper that was sourced with the word, and I swear to God, internet. It wasn't profoundly helpful in tracking down the source, but there's a lot of people. When I was doing my militia research, I once had a guy that came to me and sent me all these tapes and asked me to listen to them because he believed absolutely passionately that if he got an international driver's license, he no longer was a citizen of any country and didn't owe anybody any taxes. And I'm like, that's fine, but the federal government will put you in jail. You may think that you don't owe them any taxes, but they're going to disagree, and they have the guns and the army and the police and the courts and the prisons, right? So I think that's the big change, is once it's out there. One of the interesting things about the media these days is that you can find whatever information reinforces the beliefs you already want to have. And that's what you're getting mostly, is a lot of that kind of feedback loop where all people do is, I go use the media I like, I go listen only to if you regularly surf internet sites for news or whatever else, we all only go to the ones that share our political predispositions. And they all end up linking to each other constantly in this ever-tightening frenzy of sometimes increasing absurdity. And how do you get noticed in that intense cycle of absurdity? You get more absurd. And you get rewarded for being more absurd, right? More people link to you, more people click on your site. That, I think, has been a huge shift in that story. So I walk out of every semester either optimistic or depressed. And I haven't made up my mind about this semester yet, so... Yeah, that's a good question. The Koch brothers, those kinds of guys. I don't think there's any question that they've aided and abetted the rise of the movement. On the other hand, unless you're actually paying people to go to the rallies, you can present a slicker, better package to people that then appeals to them. I think they played a crucial role in that. Whether or not then, there's no question that with the size of the campaign contributions, particularly at the state level, what you need to understand is that many states don't have campaign contribution limits, as this state didn't until last year, right? So that's where you can, in fact, sometimes get a lot of these laws passed, or a lot of the lobbyist money can be more explicitly, here's your money, here's your policy. It's harder at the federal level. It's not impossible. It's just harder. And I think that's probably played a crucial role there. On the other hand, unless the packaging makes sense to people, unless it means something to them in their own lives, you can build the best car ever. You can build an Edsel and no one will buy it if it doesn't make sense. And so I think that's where you're trying to... The Koch brothers in that sense are Ford, but they're not building Edsel. They're building Glenn Beck, but that's a whole other problem.
They're doing marketing.
Absolutely correct. There's no question of it. No question. And the fact they've got that money behind them makes it vastly easier. There's reasons, right, where there's not poor people PACs, and there's not giant poor people rallies, and they're not giant because they don't have any money and they don't have any time. Right? The system is absolutely biased that way. There's no question of it. There's nothing new about that. It's just absolutely true. Yes?
Don't you think that ignorance has been promoted?
I must say, this is going to sound a little snarky, and I don't mean it to. Compared to what? And I mean that quite seriously. If you ask Americans in general what they know about politics, the answer is really quite bad. The thing about that is that there's nothing new about that. There really isn't. It's been true for a very, very long time that Americans know nothing about politics. They know nothing about the history of the world that they're interacting with. I did have a wonderful Saturday Night Live sketch some years ago where people, they were having like a geography lecture in elementary or high school or something like that, and they were trying to get the students to find Iraq and Afghanistan on a map. And the students said, that's not fair. Your parents' generation had the easy wars in France and Germany. and so
the base level of knowledge of most Americans about the details of history has been bad for a long time. What I do think, to follow up on the previous comment, though, is what we've created now is an instantaneous, constant media environment where your ignorance is constantly amplified and reinforced. All right, and you're rewarded for being more ignorant and more ridiculous and not rewarded for stepping back. And I have a stupid little blog going, and I must say, when I rant on something that's pretty kind of hardcore, they all love me. When I say something moderate, like you're going to have, I made the following point. I see the dean, but I'll get to him in a second. that said, you can't in one breath demand that people have good paying jobs and in the next breath try to figure out how to subvert the paywall at the New York Times. Subscribe, damn it. No one liked that one. And so that's, I think, just the big problem. It's just kind of this reinforcing feedback loop thing. But with that, I see the dean trying to...
One more question.
Sure.
Someone's hand popped up.
Sure. Please. Yeah.
I'm wondering, as the effects of all the cut in services take hold, whether we'll see a change in 2 miles out to a mile, now there are huge traffic jams going
right
to school. So people, I think, are going to start really feeling
sure
the effects.
Sure. Absolutely. I think the question of how the cuts are going to be put out are very interesting. And when you ask Americans what programs you want to cut, they'll say, don't touch entitlements and don't touch defense. There goes 80% of the United States budget. When you ask them, how should we handle the other way, they say, don't raise revenues. Don't raise taxes. Right? Well, that's pretty well screwed you right there, right? except that then when they do some further on exercises and they ask, okay, here's some alternatives and some policy options. For example, right now we cap Social Security taxes at $106,800 a year. Remove the cap. You'll get vast amounts of money into Social Security that way. We cap Medicare payroll taxes at the same rate. You'll get vast amounts of money. And you ask people, the same people who said don't raise taxes, you say, do you mind removing those caps on the wealthy? And they're like, sure, go ahead. Right? Because in fact, they don't know that they're capped for the most part. None of us, at least I'm not, in the category where that's a problem for me. Everything I earn is subject to the Medicare tax, and so as a consequence, I don't know the feeling of having income above that level. Or when you ask them, you know, cutting defense programs or whatever else, you start going program by program as opposed to, I mean, I saw it today where one of the Republicans on the floor of the House was saying, Obama won't sign this bill and therefore he doesn't support the troops. Well, yeah, but it's not the troops. It's the $250 million F-22 that after 10 years of war has never flown a combat mission. Why? It was designed to shoot down Soviet fighters over central Poland. It doesn't do you any good in Afghanistan, so we don't use it. Well, then why the hell we buy it? It's better than that, right? Because the second engine for the F-35 is not made in somebody's congressional district. It's made in 350 congressional districts. They're not stupid, the defense contractors. They didn't get rich by being stupid. And so when you start breaking it down that way, people are like, well, of course do this and of course do that. But we've created these systems where it's, I think maybe that senior, maybe we should means test Social Security. At which point in time, a lot of people get out guns and start shooting at me. Or I say, let's cut Star Wars. And people say, oh my God, Korea's gonna bomb us. North Korea, I guess. One assumes not South Korea. And so that's we just created this unbelievable screaming match of slogans rather than real honest to God conversations, and what we've ended up with is modern America. And, you know, 5,000 nuclear weapons. Yeah. But that keeps it entertaining. But anyway, thank you.